Hi, Courtney.
How are you?
How's it going? Good. How are you?
I'm doing really well. Welcome back to the podcast. It's been a while.
It has. I'm happy to be back. It's fun to be back for as a co as a guest host. It seems super special, you know? It's like featuring Alex Niklu. It's very fun.
Do you want to give the listeners a brief update about what you've been up to since you last guest co-hosted?
I got my PhD 2 years ago now, and I am currently a T42 postdoctoral fellow at Pennington Biomedical Research Center in Louisiana. It's not in intro, it's in clinical research science focusing on obesity. So it's very different. It's a very different experience, and I really like it. It's just a different world. Just really doing clinical science, and like it's a lot more physiological and nutrition related, different kind of questions, a different kind of background research that we do. And it's interesting. It's cool to come in with an intro perspective and kind of bring that and then raise questions that others might not have thought of, or you know, like it really shows what kind of skills we learn as anthropologists that is unique to our field. And I really enjoy it. I like merging the two.
That's
Yeah.
great. Well, congratulations on everything.
Thank you.
So today we are meeting with an amazing researcher, Dr. Ben Trumbull. I'm a huge fan, totally fangirling over here. Without further ado, Dr. Ben Trumbull is an associate professor in the School of Human Evolution and Social Change and the Center for Evolution and Medicine and the Institute of Human Origins at Arizona State University. His amazing work focuses on chronic diseases of aging, working to understand how environmental conditions like parasites, pathogens, food availability, and social interactions impact human health. Additionally, he takes the evolutionary life history perspective and uses field and laboratory studies to understand variation in human endocrine systems and how this influences chronic health conditions such as cardiovascular disease and Alzheimer's dementia. And he's in the waiting room, so we will let him in. Hi, Ben.
Hello. Hey, how's it going?
Good,
Good.
how
How
are
are you?
you?
Good.
We are a bit of an odd team today. We are subbing for Chris and Kara. I don't know if you remember me. I'm Alex Niklu. I used to be Kara's PhD student and then postdoc and former producer of the Sausage of Science. So when they asked me to come back, I was more than happy to do so.
Yeah, awesome.
And I am not Chris Lynn, even though I'm logged in as him. I just noticed that I'm logged in as Chris, but I am Courtney Manthey, and I am a junior service fellow at the HBA.
Awesome. Well, great to talk to you guys.
How have you been?
Good. It's that nice time of year out in Phoenix where we can go outside and it's not the surface of the sun. So, you know, hard to complain.
Yeah.
And it's spring break, which makes it even better.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I'm in Louisiana, and this is the one time of the year where it's not that fun to be in Louisiana because it's already humid, it's already hot, and it rains nonstop. It does not stop raining. And then mosquitoes are everywhere. But it lasts like 3 weeks and then we'll be through it. So, and then the weather will be nice again. So,
Oh, well, that's good at least.
Yeah,
And how
that
about you,
makes
Courtney?
sense.
Where are you?
I'm in Colorado Springs, and so our weather is insane. Sometimes it's snowing, and then the next day it's 73, and then we're on like a winter weather advisory, so we never know what's going on here.
You know, keeping things exciting.
All right,
Yeah.
let's jump right into it. As our loyal listeners know, we always start by asking the researcher how they got that start, right? Which is kind of the sausage of the podcast or the meat of the podcast, which is a play on words on how the scientist is made. So we want to know about you, how you got into anthropologist and specifically into evolutionary life perspectives.
You know, like most children, I was born, and I was always really interested in science. My father was a scientist, and so, you know, from a young age, I was involved in like some side research with him and like helping clean lab benches and things like that. And so I always loved science. And originally I wanted to be an astronaut, but I was pretty overweight and had asthma and I was short. And so I was like, well, I guess a good backup plan would be family business of, you know, being a professor. And but I didn't want to do exactly what my dad did. Well, I really did because he was an entomologist, and I think that entomology is absolutely fascinating. Insects are way cooler than humans, but I didn't want to fall in his footsteps. And I didn't want to be in his shadow because he's quite good at what he does. And so figured, well, the next best thing was humans. They were almost as cool as insects. And so that was like a good like follow-up. Then in undergrad, I was an anthro and psych major. One of the aspects of psychology that I really liked was the ability to do these like focused experiments to get at some kind of a problem and being able to do like kind of well-defined experiments. But one of the things that I really didn't like was that, you know, it was basically just undergrads that many psych researchers are focused on. It's just such a small age range and just a small socioeconomic status, and it really doesn't give us any idea of the overall human variation. And in grad school, I was lucky enough to work with Eric Alden Smith, who is one of the premier human behavioral ecologists. And then I also combined that with human biology and human physiology. So I had kind of the human life history theory, and then also was able to add in the human physiology.
Very cool. So, where did you go to grad school?
University of Washington.
And then you did you get a postdoc afterwards, or did you get?
Yeah. So while I was a grad student, I reached out to Hilly Kaplan and Mike Gervin, and I had a series of studies that I really wanted to do looking at acute changes in testosterone. So when males in the US engage in, you know, kind of male-male physical activity, there tends to be a spike in testosterone. What we've known in the US, people tend to have higher levels of testosterone than other populations. And it's not that actually like our levels are high, or sorry, that our levels are normal. I would say that a much lower level of testosterone would be normal. It's that we've removed a bunch of constraints. So testosterone's really, maintaining a high testosterone phenotype is really energetically costly. And so by having clean access to food and water and, you know, essentially infinite calories if we want, then we're able to maintain these kind of evolutionarily novel levels of testosterone. But at the time, there was some debate whether or not guys in non-industrial populations who would, we expect to have lower levels of testosterone would still be able to have that kind of spike in testosterone. And so I reached out to Hilly and Mike and asked them if it would be possible to do a study like that with the Chimane. And at that same time, they had been really wanting to kind of branch more into the biomedical world. And they had like their first NIH grant, and they invited me down for the summer. I learned a ton, and we did some really cool work together. Then they invited me on as a postdoc, and then now I'm a co-director.
Wow, what a trajectory from, postdoc on a project to being one of the leaders of it. That's incredible. Is the change in testosterone when you take away other energetically costly factors, is that true in both sexes or is it just in men?
It's true in both sexes, and so the spike in males is much higher than the spike in females. But both sexes do have an acute increase in testosterone during competitive events. And as it turns out, the Chimane had essentially the exact same percentage increase as US males. The average percent change was the same. It's just that they had lower levels of testosterone to begin with. So they still could spike testosterone. And I think that's because the mechanisms that maintain kind of your homeostatic levels of testosterone and those that are involved in acute changes in testosterone, I think it's two different mechanisms.
Well, speaking of research, I think this is a good way to lead us into our next question. So, you have a new article that recently came out in the Journals of Gerontology Series A, Biological Sciences and Medical Sciences, entitled Poor Oral Health is Associated with Inflammation, Aortic Valve Calcification, and Brain Volume Among Forager Farmers. Can you tell us a little bit about the piece?
So until about a year and a half ago, I didn't really care much about teeth except for my own. And generally then it was only about like twice a day when I was brushing them or when I had something stuck in there. But the Chimane government, so when the project started about 20 years ago, the Chimane Health and Life History Project, it's a large multidisciplinary project led by Hilary Kaplan, Mike Gervin, John Stieglitz, and myself on the kind of the anthropology team. And then we also work with a number of Alzheimer's researchers like Margie Gatz and cardiovascular researchers like Greg Thomas and Randy Thompson. And you know, our chief Bolivian doctor is Daniel E. Rodriguez. We work with a number of Chimane collaborators as well. But when the project first started about 20 years ago, it was going to be focused kind of on grandparents and the kind of grandmother hypothesis and looking at some things related to that. And Hilly Kaplan and Mike Gervin, who started the project, they asked the Chimane government, like, what do you guys want to get out of this? Like, we don't want to just show up and like extract data. Like, what would you guys want to get? And they said, well, we really need help getting medical care. That, you know, because they don't speak Spanish, it was difficult for Chimane to get help at the hospital. And then doctors weren't going out into the kind of the forest where the Chimane were. And so they said, like, could you help us with that? And so that's actually why kind of the project went a more biomedical route to go for NIH funding so that we could help pay for patient costs. So right now we have a mobile medical team that goes from community to community, and we're able to collect some really interesting and unique data, but also provide through the Bolivian doctors that we've hired to the project that they can help like provide medical care. And so, and it doesn't matter if the person's, involved in the project or not, we're able to provide a lot of medical care for a lot of folks. But we had, the Chimane government came to us and they said, well, what about teeth? Like, you guys are helping out with doctors and that's great, but like, we have a lot of issues with oral health and like people who have are losing teeth and dentures, and like, is there anything you guys could do to help? We knew that the only way that we could in the future ask the National Institutes of Health or National Science Foundation or anybody like that for grant money related to oral health was if we collected some preliminary data. What we've been doing for a while is we've been really focused on cardiovascular disease and Alzheimer's. When it comes to chronic diseases of aging, most of the research is in industrialized populations. There isn't too much research outside of that. And the world that we live in today is very different than the environments in which humans evolved. And I can't point to any single population and say, like, oh, that's the perfect exemplar of the human past. But what we do know is that sedentary urban life is evolutionarily novel. So if you compress like the last 5 million years of human evolution into a single calendar year, we're hunter-gatherers on January 1st, February 1st, March, April, May, December 31st at 11:40 p.m., that's when the Industrial Revolution occurred. So what we're used to as life being normal today is just this tiniest little blip for the human existence. And so working with populations like the Chimane, we can get a better idea of what were these chronic diseases of aging like throughout human history. And so we've been working for the past almost decade or so with a group of cardiologists called the HORUS team, looking at cardiovascular disease. And we found a CT scanner in Trinidad, Bolivia, that had been donated by the French government, but the machine was broken and there weren't many personnel with a high level of training. And so we brought down US techs, we fixed the machine and trained local folks on how to collect that data. And then we did a large study of cardiovascular disease. It's easy to look at like blood pressure or lipid levels and say like, oh, you have high blood pressure or you have, bad lipid levels. But most people in the US don't actually know if they have heart disease or not until they have their first heart attack. Or if you get like an angiogram. The other way that you can do it is with a gated coronary CT scan, which is using computed tomography to look at the calcium in your heart. And if you have calcium in those arteries in your heart, then that's cardiovascular disease. And so what we did was we would do these big campaigns where we bring people from their local communities first to our clinic in San Borja, and there we do a full medical workup. And then we would work with social workers at that Bolivian hospital. And if you're Chimane and you're over the, if you're indigenous, you're over the age of 60, then you qualify for free healthcare. And many of these individuals, so while, they'll see our licensed Bolivian doctors when they come through about once every year, year and a half, we can't do things like surgeries. So if you're a Chimane guy over the age of 60, you've probably got a hernia, you probably got cataract, pterygium, all sorts of conditions that we couldn't treat in the field. Did was we worked with the social worker there to get them set up with any sort of appointments they could need. If they have TB, then they could see the pulmonologist. They could see the surgeon for their hernia, surgeon for cataracts. And then we bring people, we do gated coronary CT scan, and then also a brain CT. And then they would see all the different specialists they need to see. And that way we could provide some higher level medical care that we couldn't normally do in the field while also collecting some really unique data. With that, we found the lowest levels of cardiovascular disease of any population yet examined. That was in 2017. Around that same time, we started working on Alzheimer's disease and related dementias. So Alzheimer's is the single most expensive disease a person could get. In the US, typically the way it's done is you would, if you'd be referred to like an Alzheimer's center, you would go and they do a series of cognitive exams, they do an MRI, interviews with family members. Once they've done all of that, they would do what's called a consensus conference. And that's where a group of gerontologists, neurologists, psychiatrists sit down and then they present the case. And then they'll sit there and they'll debate, like, oh, well, they scored well on these domains, but they scored poorly on these cognitive domains, and they scored well on this, but poor on this. Family members reported this and this. And then they'll come to a provisional diagnosis of, is this dementia? Is this Alzheimer's type dementia? Is this Lewy body? Is this, just mild cognitive impairment, or is this normal cognition? And so we worked with that group led by Margie Goetz and Helena Chu, And we I spent quite some time out there with them and saw how they deal with patients, how they do all these interviews, and then how they do these consensus conferences. And then we took all those instruments and we made them culturally appropriate. That's actually not easy, but like, so some things like, who's president? Those are the types of questions that, similar things to that are asked, or like, where are you right now? Are asked in by medical professionals, but that's something we couldn't exactly ask. So we had to modify those sort of things. For example, part of the mini mental state exam, you get asked seven, or you get a list of seven words. And so we had to take those words and then find similar words, but make sure they had the same number of syllables so that we weren't adding like six syllable words when most of the English words are, one to two syllables. So we did all of that. And then we actually worked with Elena Chu, who's one of the key people involved in the mini mental state exam. And she helped us make that more culturally appropriate. That's the kind of the background on how we get to where we're starting, which is with oral health. We wanted to see if oral health is associated with dementia or with cardiovascular disease. Because in the US, there are many studies that find associations between oral health and dementia, and also many that find associations between oral health and cardiovascular disease. There have been a bunch of different mechanisms that have been proposed, stuff like there's oral inflammation, and then that is, like in your mouth, like from periodontal disease, and that's just causing overall a higher level of inflammatory processes throughout the body. Others have potentially argued that, okay, maybe there's bacteria entering the bloodstream. So if you got these damaged teeth or you got periodontal disease, that's a way that bacteria could then enter the bloodstream and then make their way to your heart or your brain and be associated with cardiovascular or Alzheimer's. It's been known for a long time that if you switch to a soft diet, that oftentimes has some negative cognitive outcomes associated with it. And that could actually have something to do with actual nerve stimulation from chewing. And there have been some really cool studies in mouse models where they'll remove their teeth and give them a soft diet, and then you see declines in cognition, and then they'll give them crowns, and then they can rescue some of that cognitive decline. There's also the possibility of dietary deficiencies. So if you can't chew and you aren't getting enough B vitamins, that could be associated with some poor cognitive outcomes. Then there's always the reverse causality, where if I am starting to decline cognitively, I might start forgetting to brush my teeth, and then my teeth are going to decline. But one of the problems is that it's difficult to study this in the US because in the US, individuals who have lower socioeconomic status oftentimes lack access to dental care. And those same individuals tend to live in, food deserts where the foods they have access to aren't as healthy, safe parks or gyms to work out. And so those individuals also then tend to be at higher risk for obesity or high levels of inflammation. And then those can have independent effects on cardiovascular disease or Alzheimer's. It's kind of difficult to disentangle all these things in the US. And so working with a population like the Chimane, we can where basically no one has access to dental care, then everyone's on the same playing field and everyone's, growing and hunting and fishing most of their own food. There we can kind of disentangle some of these associations between socioeconomic status and how oral health actually impacts cardiovascular disease and Alzheimer's.
This project is a wonderful example of how, as an anthropologist, you can have these long-term collaborations, but also among anthropologists, but also with public health professionals, right? And then bring this public health directly to the people you're working with and how that has direct impacts on those populations and on their general health. That I think that's wonderful. I'm curious to know more about how, so I know you mentioned that there are differences in already in the US, right? Like people who have access to dental care, or those are the same people who tend to be in lower socioeconomic situations or have live in food deserts, things like that. But how are the Chimani different in other ways as well, right? Because I know in the paper you mentioned a few things about they use their teeth maybe more for specific things.
Yeah. So, I mean, for humans throughout all of human history, teeth have always been tools. And I know, like, my dentist always told me, like, teeth are not tools. I always kind of disagree with that because I think that they're kind of like one of our own, like, sort of built-in tools. In populations where you don't have access to toothbrushes and toothpaste and clean water to do that with, and where you don't have access to any sort of dental care and dental hygiene, we do see kind of poorer oral health outcomes than what we expect in the US. Among the Chimani, for example, like almost the first teeth that are lost are the incisors. And that's because of using incisors for all sorts of different types of eating, tool use, and that's not just the Chimane. You know, we see similar things with the Hadza, with the Guarani, like a whole bunch of different, basically any group that you've looked at oral health and any indigenous subsistence population, they're going to be using their teeth for a variety of things that we in the US may not typically use them for. On top of that, women tend to have slightly poorer oral health outcomes. And that actually has a lot to do, we think, with the cost of fertility. You know, I think they call it the one tooth per child rule. If you in the literature, that kind of used to be what it was called. We actually find for the Chimane, it's about half a tooth per child. Women, you know, they're using their energy to build a new baby. And that requires a bunch of different micronutrients like calcium, but also just calories. Women on average among Chimane lose about 4.6 more teeth for any given age. We also see, you know, faster rates of tooth loss in women compared to men. Another possibility too, though, is that just based on like types of physical activity and what people are doing throughout the day. So the average woman among Chimane has about 9.1 kids, and women tend to be a little bit closer to the homestead. They still do a fair amount of like, you know, like still by US standards, an incredible amount of physical activity, like 2 to 3 times as much as people in the US. But they, you know, if you have 9 kids, and that means that you probably have, you know, a 6-year-old, a 4-year-old, you know, a 2-year-old and a newborn simultaneously. And that's a lot of kids to watch. And so women tend to stay closer to the house, and they also tend to do most of the cooking. And so men will oftentimes go and, you know, clear part of the forest when they're chopping down big trees for horticulture, or go hunting for the day. And when they do that, they aren't eating. But women who are staying at the house and they're cooking for their kids, they're going to be eating more. And basically, every time you eat carbohydrates, you change the acidity of your mouth. And that leads to bacterial growth and proliferation. And so, if you're eating more times throughout the day, then you're going to potentially have higher risk for oral health declines compared to guys that are just out all day and not eating anything. There also are a number of like fruit, like manai, which it's sort of like, imagine an apricot if 90% of it was the pit. And so you kind of just scrape it, scrape the flesh off of the fruit with your front teeth. And so, you know, like that alone causes, you know, some damage over time.
Well, and also speaking about inflammation and just how this population is different from like a US population, you note that, you know, oral health may impact inflammatory markers, and inflammation is a risk factor for both cardiovascular disease and brain health. And the Chesmene have high background inflammation from their exposure to parasites and pathogens. So even though it's not directly discussed in this piece, can you talk about the relationship between parasites, pathogens, and inflammation in foraging populations, likely involving, I guess, the hygiene hypothesis and such?
In subsistence populations that don't have access to like sanitation and clean water, we tend to see higher rates of intestinal parasites. So in particular, things like helminths. Helminths are if you think about different pathogens and what would have survived. So like just like from a modeling perspective. So just as a thought experiment, you think like what would have survived throughout a lot of the human evolutionary past when people lived in kind of relatively small groups that didn't come into contact with each other all the time. If you think of something like COVID, that wouldn't spread very well in those populations because if it infected some small group of 5 or 6 people or even 10 people that were part of a small band, and then they didn't come into other people for 2 to 3 weeks while they were out foraging, then that's not going to spread well. So those high burn pathogens like COVID or influenza, those wouldn't do a great job of spreading in those sort of populations. Things that caused that were lower virulence, so they didn't cause as much damage to the host, but they also didn't cause the host to have as strong of an immune response. And that would last a really long time until they would make it so that you could come into contact with other groups and be able to spread those. Those types of pathogens likely would have done better in the past. It's one of those things that, like, you know, it's hard to get archaeological evidence for. And so this is mostly just kind of a modeling idea. But from a modeling perspective, things like helminths, if you have them and they can survive for quite some time in your intestines, and then you pass on the eggs, and then you could pass those to other people, those could survive quite well in those types of populations. And certainly when we look at like coprolites, we find examples of helminths. And a lot of the ideas behind the old friends hypothesis or the hygiene hypothesis are that basically we develop tolerance for some of these helmets, that they didn't cause that much damage to the host, and therefore our immune systems didn't fully kick them out the way that we would other pathogens. And then in doing so, a lot of those helmets will actually modulate our own immune function. So they'll reduce some of the pro-inflammatory responses so that we don't have as strong of a response. It's part of the way that they can survive and do so well inside of our systems. And so populations like the Chimane, for example, about 75% of adults have intestinal parasites at any given time. That can modify immune function in a bunch of different interesting ways. So we tend to see, lower pro-inflammatory responses. One of the problems with that literature in general is that it's difficult to compare across populations. If you have three labs that all run the same samples, if they're running different assays, if they're looking at different biomarkers, even if they're just using different equipment, they can get different results. In fact, like they've done some analyses across a bunch of clinical labs, like not anthropologists, but like straight university hospitals, and they'll find big differences if they send them all the same sample and have them run those samples. So it can be difficult to compare exactly. But generally speaking, we see different types of inflammation in the US than what we see in populations like the Chimane or a great group of researchers that work with the Shuar. And so the Shuar project, they also see relatively high rates of inflammation as well. But the inflammation that we see in those populations is due to either helmets or other sorts of infectious processes. And that's different than the inflammation that we see generally in the US. A lot of the US inflammation we see is what we call sterile inflammation. And that has a somewhat different, set of cytokines involved, somewhat different. It's not due to pathogens. It's actually due to largely excess adiposity. So having higher levels of body fat that can cause the release of some inflammatory processes, things like smoking exposure to air pollution. So different populations that have different, types of exposure will have different inflammatory responses. So if we look at a population like the Chimane, they have similar C-reactive protein as kind of a generalized marker of inflammation. And they have somewhat similar C-reactive protein among the Chimane to people in the US in aging adults. But in the Chimane, it's not because of body fat, it's because of intestinal parasites and respiratory infections and diarrheal disease. Whereas in the US, it tends to be more from having higher levels of adiposity and exposure to environmental toxins.
See, I'm coming from working with Tara C. Pon Robbins at UCCS. And so that's why I had to mention the old friends hypothesis or hygiene hypothesis, because I was like, ah, you know about the relationship.
Yeah, Dr. Sipan Robbins does great work, and as does the rest of the Shuar Health and Life History Project.
Yes, Tara is like one of the loves of my life, and I'm sure she'll listen. So hi, Tara.
You kind of mentioned that there were different, methods depending on like when you compare between populations and all that. So I kind of wanted to ask if you d minded diving a little bit deeper into your methods, into how you collected the different data, because you're looking at very different things, right? Between inflammation, cardiovascular disease, dementia, oral health.
Yeah. So, in terms of looking at brain atrophy and dementia, we used a combination of two methods, one of brain CT and the other being a set of interviews with the individual, with family members of that individual. Because let's say I am in early stage dementia. And if you were interviewing me and you might say like, oh, are you forgetting family members' names? I could say no, because I don't realize that I am. And so I might not be the best person to ask about that sort of thing. Now, if you're asking about, like a cognitive exam, that's obviously that should go to me. But like, if you're asking about what are some of the things that I'm starting to falter in, that would be better to ask a family member. So for that kind of line of inquiry, we used a series of metrics involving interviews with them and with a family member. And these were we then take all of that same information and we actually send it to the same consensus team that does the diagnoses in the U.S. So we work with USC Alzheimer's Center, and basically after they see all of their patients for the day, we then have them stick around and then go through the exact same types of data, put into the exact same formats by Margie Gatz and Helena Chu. They go through and make sure that the data look almost identical, and then they go through and they look at those patients, and then they make a consensus diagnosis: is this dementia? Is this just mild cognitive impairment? Is this normal? And if it's dementia, is it Alzheimer's type or is it not Alzheimer's type? So we have them do all of kind of that sort of work for the dementia part. Then we work with Andre Iremia, who's a computational physicist and part of the project, and he took matched MRI data and CT data. So in the US, we generally use MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, to look at soft tissues like the brain. But in Bolivia, we didn't have access to any MRI machines. And so it's really difficult to get liquid helium, and MRIs are incredibly expensive and use a lot of energy. But we did have access to a CT machine. So what we did was Andre took matched CT images and MRI images from the same US patients, and then was able to develop tools to basically compare the two. And that's not just important for this study, that's actually a really useful tool for brain injury around the world, because there are a lot of places that don't have access to MRI. And even rural hospitals in the US oftentimes don't have access to MRI. And so being able to basically have a plug-in that can convert a CT image into an MRI style image, so you can see differences in gray and white matter, is actually a really important tool. And so that's how we looked at like brain atrophy and or differences in brain volume with age, I should say. Not necessarily brain atrophy, because this is a cross-sectional study. Then for heart imaging, we used a gated coronary CT scan, which is where you have basically an EKG hooked up to a patient when they undergo a CT scan. And then what it'll do is it'll only take images when the heart is in a specific phase. So remember, your heart's still beating. And so if your heart's just beating and you were just to take a constant image of that, then every basically cyclical scan that a CT scan does as it goes in a helix around your body would be at a different part of the heartbeat. So instead, the gated CT scan only takes images when the heart's in a specific part of the beat. So that's what we did for the kind of the brain atrophy and then the cardiovascular disease. And then we also had a oral health assessment where we had a medical doctor go through and like for each tooth, rate whether it was, healthy, if it had caries, if it had extreme caries, if it was broken or damaged, and if it was missing. And in the US, we oftentimes find that missing teeth are associated with dementia in particular, and also with cardiovascular disease. And so we're really interested to see, like, okay, do missing teeth have the same impact in this population as in the US? And at the same time, we also we looked at several different markers of inflammation. So looked at white blood cell counts, C-reactive protein, and then a 15 cytokine panel, all done from a fasting morning blood draw. And so I've mentioned before that, in the US, there have been a couple of things that they've thought might be associated with or reasons why oral health could impact Alzheimer's and cardiovascular disease. That was that oral inflammation could lead to systemic inflammation. It could be the bacteria entering through the bloodstream through damaged, broken teeth, or through periodontal disease, that nerve stimulation, dietary deficiencies, or that kind of reverse causality. And so what we're able to do here that was kind of unique was we were able to look and say, okay, is there an association between oral health and inflammation? And if there, whether there is or there isn't, is there an association between oral health and brain volume and dementia status and also cardiovascular disease? And so what we found was that in this population, individuals who had missing teeth, that didn't have any impact on inflammation. It was actually only damaged teeth. So in the US, one of the things that would happen is if I had a broken tooth, I didn't have health insurance, but I went to an ER or to a dentist, it would be seen as an emergency, and they would remove that. And that might create, because of our system, massive medical debt down the road, but like in an emergency, I would be treated, because a broken tooth is a medical emergency and very painful. But for a population like the Chimane, they don't have access to that. And so we actually saw a large number of broken teeth. And so like broken teeth that were basically potential ways for bacteria to enter the bloodstream. And these are also going to be creating a bunch of localized inflammation. And so what we found was that missing teeth weren't associated with inflammation, because once your tooth is gone and that socket is healed over, then it's just like having gums there. But if you had a broken tooth, then that's an open pathway for bacteria and other things to enter into your bloodstream. And therefore, those individuals tended to have higher inflammatory markers across many of the different markers of inflammation that we used. We found that in terms of association between oral health and inflammation. And then we found that people who had more broken teeth, but not missing teeth, tended to have smaller brain volumes. And one of the things about brain volume is that your brain grows to a certain size and your skull matches that size. And so as you age, if you see more basically empty space in the skull, that can be used as a measure of basically like declining brain volume with age. And what we found were that individuals who had, but again, this is a cross-sectional study, so we're not measuring this longitudinally yet. And so what we found were that people who had broken teeth tended to have lower brain volumes than those who didn't have these broken or damaged teeth. And then when it comes to cardiovascular disease, we didn't see any association between any measure of tooth loss or tooth damage and having actual calcium in your heart. And that's what that calcium in your heart in those arteries, that's what leads to a myocardial infarction or heart attack. And then you might have very, very low levels of coronary artery calcium. And we didn't find any associations there. But what we did find were that people who had more broken teeth tended to have higher levels of atrial valve calcification. And the atrial valve calcification is oftentimes associated with basically infectious processes in many populations. Now, we couldn't necessarily assess that, but in the future, we hope to be able to look at kind of like the oral microbiome, but then also the serum microbiome. So we can look at what's circulating in the mouth or what bacterial species are in the mouth, and are those same ones in the bloodstream? And do people who have broken teeth, are they more likely to have those oral bacteria in the bloodstream? And then is having that oral bacteria in the bloodstream associated with greater levels of brain atrophy or with greater atrial valve calcification? So that's kind of one of the next steps. But again, we were largely doing this study so that we could kind of put together some pilot data so that in the future we can apply for grants so that we could help provide dental care for the population. And then also so we can get a much better in-depth look at how, you know, these health factors. The one of the problems in the US is that we have this disconnect between the mouth and the body. Dentists, those deal with oral health, and then doctors deal with the rest of the body. Bacteria and infectious processes and inflammation, those don't have those same disciplinary boundaries. They don't say like, oh, sorry, I'm just oral health related bacteria, so I'm going to stay here in the realm of the dentist and not leave this area of the body. It's not really how that works. And so instead, we end up with this kind of unfortunate disconnect. And National Institutes of Health is starting to realize this. And in fact, this last summer, they actually had a workshop looking at dementia and oral health and arguing that this is a really understudied area and that we need more research in this area. And that's where populations, working with populations like the Chimane, could actually be a real benefit. Because again, we can remove some of the confounding from socioeconomic status and obesity, and we can look at kind of direct impacts of oral health on cardiovascular and brain aging.
That leads to like the last little questions that we have. First, in just a few words, if you had like one main takeaway of your research, of this work, what would it be?
I think that really understanding how oral health is going to be associated with cardiovascular and brain aging and chronic diseases of aging in general is going to be really important. And one of the things that I found really shocking, actually, about this was that if we're talking about a population that has really high levels of parasites and pathogens, you know, 75% of adults have intestinal parasites, 50% have a respiratory infection, you know, they have a whole bunch of inflammatory processes. And above and beyond all of that, we saw strong signals associated with having broken or damaged teeth. And so that means that oral health is playing a really critical role above and beyond parasites. And that means that, like, this is really something that we should be thinking more about. And that, you know, there are lots of, you know, I mentioned that, you know, if you're in the US and you have a broken tooth, most people will go and get that taken care of. But there are tons of people with periodontal disease where they have gums that are a way that bacteria can enter the bloodstream. And so that's a potential area that we're really not thinking as much about as we should.
Well, absolutely remarkable research, as always. As somebody who has like a weird obsession with teeth, like I have a model tooth that you can't see in the background. I feel like I should have like brought it over. And that's one of the hard things about a podcast is you can't see, because this whole time Alex and I are nodding along like this is amazing. I never want this interview to end because it's like just preach. So unfortunately, we do have to wrap it up, but we do have one final question for you. It's my personal favorite. I always try to snag it and try to ask because it's so cool. So as you know, we are aiming to bring back the annual Human Biology Association talent show at our upcoming meeting here in March. So if we were able to pull it off, what would your like special skill or talent be?
So I would say that well, I couldn't really do it at the talent show, but I would say that like I really like to cook. And so, because it's basically just lab work that you can eat. And so I really like that. And so I love cooking and like trying out all sorts of different ways to cook. I was breaking bread before it was cool when COVID happened. Into cooking forever. And so I really like cooking. And I would say that like if I had a special skill that I would like lean into, it would probably be cooking related, especially since anybody can get a sous vide now. Highly recommend. Just get a sous vide. I will talk about this forever, like as long as I'll talk about my research, but like sous vide are perfect. They'll cook any sort of meat or vegetable to whatever temperature you want exactly perfectly. And then you just finish it up on a grill or in a pan. So I guess that would be my talent show skill.
I love it.
Definitely.
But yeah. That was it for us today. Thank you very much. This was incredibly enlightening and super interesting. And what a different topic than what we're used to. Although we cover so much on the sausage of science, but this is really like a lot, so many topics overlapping that come together, and it really shows, how much anthropology can actually help with when it comes to public health understanding and bridging those gaps between different fields. And it's just fantastic to hear about this. Really making my little heart flutter.
Well, thanks so much for having me, and thanks for all the great insightful questions.
Well,
Right.
Dr. Ben Trumbull and Tri-Tip Master, if people want to get in touch with you, how can they find you?
So you can go to my website, trumbullab.org, or they can email me, and happy to chat.
Awesome. And what about you,
We'll link.
Alex?
I'm at alexandra.niklu@pbrc.edu. So if anyone wants to email me for whatever reason, I'm happy to chat as well.
Awesome. And I'm Courtney Manthey on X as Holy Latoli. I'm also on Facebook and I am the HBA webmaster. So if you write to any of their social media websites or accounts, you will find me, and also at www.holylatoli.com. Awesome. Thank you, guys.